David now finds himself in the southern part of Judah, a little to the west of the Dead Sea, in the area surrounding a little settlement called Ziph. It is a very inhospitable region of the land of Israel. It's a mountainous region, and not really that pleasant a place to live in. Sparsely populated, and knowing great extremes of weather and of terrain. The name Ziph itself is interesting because it comes from a word, the significance in part of which means to melt, being linked with refinement. And the events in this area were certainly such as to melt David's heart, to break his heart, perhaps even melt him to tears, as he goes through intense times of trial and tribulation. But as in any refinement process, the Lord only uses these events to further and to deepen the work of grace that had already been done in his heart. David is the servant of God, the Spirit-filled servant of the Lord. And the Lord, in bringing him into these circumstances, purposes only to deepen and to develop that work of grace that has been begun in his heart and in his life, and to equip him for the calling that God has yet before him. David, in these events, in this scenario, was driven once more to the Lord. He is driven away from men to his God. How often in life we need to learn that lesson. We need to learn it repeatedly. Often the Lord has to bring us repeatedly into difficulties and into trials and troubles, into circumstances that cause our heart to melt and to break our heart, in order to teach us you can't depend on men. You can't depend on the arm of the flesh. You can only lean on God. This is a lesson that the child of God needs to learn repeatedly. It's not a one-off thing. It's not just something that we learn once and that's it, imprinted on our mind forever. No, sadly we have to come back time and time and time again to learn the only one I can lean on is the Lord. And that's what David proves in these circumstances. Again, he learns by hard personal experience that there is none that he can rely on but the Lord his God. There are a number of things that we want just to look at from the passage this evening. And first of all, we're going to give some attention to that visit by Jonathan that is recorded in the verse 16 through 18. This was an encouragement. This was a time, no doubt, when David's heart was lifted. As Jonathan, a very close and dear friend of David's, comes now to visit him in the wood in the area of Ziph. Often it is the Lord's way to send encouragement to his people from strange quarters, surprisingly, suddenly, unexpectedly, perhaps without warning. There's Jonathan, and he has come to visit with David, and we're told that the effect of his visit ultimately was that he strengthened his hand in God. After the trials of Keilah, the betrayal that had occurred at that city, and the heartbreak that must have followed with that treachery. After those events, David, I'm sure, was in sore need of a friend. He felt himself in need, I'm sure, of human friendship. And that's where Jonathan comes. How good and how tender the Lord is, even in such things as this, to send a friend in a time of adversity. After Keilah, before the looming crisis that was already developing in Ziph, already moment by moment and day by day the tension was building as the circumstance develops, where Saul is on his way, and as we shall see, it climaxes in almost David's destruction. But that circumstance was now developing, and so in the wake of the disappointments and the heartaches of Keilah, and as new circumstances and trials are developing, the Lord graciously sends to him encouragement in the form of Jonathan. How good the Lord is, you know. He doesn't send trial after trial after trial after trial. But along the way there's encouragement in between. And that's what this little event proved to be for David. The Lord uses David's friend here to be a means of encouragement to him. Now, there are many things that we could say about Jonathan that would indicate his failure, his shortcomings. We don't want to be blind to them, but at the same time we don't want to be blind to the encouraging effect that his visit had for David. He is significantly described here as Saul's son. That is significant, I suppose, for a number of reasons. Significant because Jonathan at this point shows more of Saul than he does of David in his life and conduct. He shows a wrong and a foolish loyalty to his father and to his father's house. His father had rejected God. His father had turned aside into the ways of sin and wickedness. Jonathan knew full well that God had raised up David as a new king. He indicates as much even in these words. But Jonathan didn't side with David as he should have. There were shortcomings. There were failures. He's described as the son of Saul, Saul's son. But you know, that may well be included here just to indicate that even on that side, there were those who had tenderness toward David. Maybe there were more like Jonathan. Maybe that's the message that David got from this, that although Saul is leading a campaign of terror to destroy him, there were those, even in his own household, who were in fact sympathetic with David's cause, though they didn't stand with him as we could have wished. But yet there was nonetheless a sympathy there. You remember how even Paul spoke of those who in Caesar's household were believers. And here is an instance of one sympathetic to the cause, although sadly and wrongly, I believe, Jonathan remained in Saul's camp and didn't separate to stand with David. But nonetheless, he comes and he encourages David. We may be blessed, encouraged, even by those who do not necessarily agree with all that we would stand for. On a church level, there are many fine Christians who don't agree with the things that we stand for. But they can be an encouragement to us at times. We might have to agree to differ on certain matters, but they can be an encouragement, as Jonathan was an encouragement here to David. I think that there is a tragic insight here into the kind of ministry that Jonathan could have had with David. He comes, and it is said of his visit by the Spirit of God that he strengthened David's hand in God. They enjoyed close friendship. No doubt there was a special time of renewed friendship together. But it indicates, or the words indicate here, that the nature of this visit was primarily spiritual. David had his hand strengthened in the Lord. Their time together was one of spiritual significance. Again, in the verse 18, rather, there is a reference to the covenant that was made. It was made before the Lord, in the presence of the Lord, at the face of the Lord, before Jehovah. This gives us some insight into the nature of this visit. Jonathan, despite his failures, despite his shortcomings, yet in meeting with David, there is a time of spiritual kinship, friendship, and fellowship. There is this covenant that is made. Perhaps the terms of the covenant may be reflected in the words of the verse 17. There may well have been a solemn affirmation before God of what Jonathan said, that this was a solemn statement. Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. Maybe this covenant was an agreement to that end. Maybe it was an agreement before God that Jonathan would work as far as he was prepared to work for David in the advance of his kingdom, and that when the kingdom came, he would share in that rule with David. If nothing else, we can learn from this experience the benefit of friendship like this. It's an encouraging thing. It's an encouraging thing to have friends who share at least some of those goals and visions that we have for the work of God. We may not find many that will see things exactly as we see them. And I suppose there's a sense in which we never find anybody that really sees things exactly as we see them. But nonetheless, there is encouragement and blessing to be gained by having fellowship and friendship with the people of God. I was thinking of some references just to the effect that friends can have over in the New Testament. Most of them actually relate to the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 28. And the verse 14, Paul finds himself in a time of trial. He's actually in chains. He's coming near the end of that rather incident-filled journey to Rome as a prisoner, having escaped shipwreck and now making progress toward the city of Rome. And we read in the verse 14 that they found some brethren in the city of Puteoli and were desired to tarry with them 7 days, and so we went toward Rome. And from thence, when the brethren heard of us, they came to meet us as far as Appii Forum and the three taverns, whom, when Paul saw, he thanked God and took courage. Even the apostle here is encouraged. I'm sure maybe those brethren that came to meet with him didn't think themselves of any great significance. They thought maybe they were coming for the encouragement as they went to meet the mighty champion of the faith. But we're told that he took courage. You know, there's a lesson to be learned. We too can be Jonathans. Ah, we might have our faults and failures, and surely we do. But our friendship, maybe an instance on a personal level of fellowship together in the things of God with another believer, that can be a great encouragement. You might think, well, what can I contribute? Well, sometimes we contribute more than we realize. I've often found that you go to visit with somebody and you spend a little time with them. You drink tea with them. You come away. You wonder, well, I wonder what that really accomplished. But in the conversation that you've had together of the Lord, there has been that which has stirred the heart and warmed the heart and encouraged that dear soul. So it was with David. So it was with Paul here. In 1 Corinthians 16. Again, this is another incident in Paul's life. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 17. I am glad of the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus. For that which was lacking on your part, they have supplied. Now, there was a genuine need here. There was something lacking, perhaps many things lacking. Some material thing that Paul had need of. Some financial thing, material thing that was lacking. And oh, how glad it was when these three men named turned up. He was glad of their friendship. Glad of their help. Then one more reference, 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and the verse 6. Nevertheless, oh, we better take verse 5 just for the context. For when we were come into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Without were fightings, within were fears. Nevertheless, God that comforteth those that are cast down, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And not by his coming only, but by the consolation wherewith he was comforted in you. When he told us your earnest desire, your mourning, your fervent mind toward me, so that I rejoiced the more. This is the effect of a friend, a godly friend, coming to share in the things of the Lord and to engage in fellowship. And David, in the most unlikely place, in the most unlikely circumstances, the Lord has a friend show up there just to encourage his heart. But you'll see that Jonathan's visit encouraged David because he was directed to the Lord. Now that's where the encouragement comes in. It wasn't just the friendship. It wasn't just being able to sit down and talk about the good old days or the things that are past. We're told explicitly that Jonathan strengthened David's hand in God. David was strengthened. His hands, to use the biblical metaphor, may well have been hanging down. His knees may have become feeble as he was fleeing for his life, maybe getting weary of the pursuit of Saul and the treachery of men, getting weary of it all. But his hand was strengthened in God as Jonathan visited with him on this occasion. This renewed strength then was derived from the Lord. Now, on an ordinary human level, even spiritual fellowship with the saints of God, with kindred spirits, has an invigorating effect. It's a good thing. It's an encouraging thing for God's people to assemble together, to visit together, to fellowship together. Even in ordinary things, it's an encouragement for God's people to get together and talk about the weather. There are places to talk about the weather and places not to talk about the weather. But even on that ordinary level, out on the street, in our homes, for God's people to fellowship together, that is an encouraging thing because it's a meeting of kindred minds and spirits. But this was more than that. Because the reality of the situation here is that if that's all that this meant to David, it was just the meeting of a friend. David had to meet the enemy alone, for his friend left him. And if the only strength he got was the encouragement of having a friend beside him for a little while, well, that strength would very soon have evaporated whenever David realized Jonathan's gone and I'm still in this pickle and I'm on my own. Our strength must be sourced in the Lord. And whenever we get together, whenever we have fellowship together, even on that ordinary friendly level, if we're going to be an encouragement, a means of strength to the other, we must get to the Lord. The Lord must be part of our visiting. The Lord must be part of our fellowshipping together. If there's going to be any lasting strength in our hand. But thank God that there is such an outcome from even a visit like this. As we've said, Jonathan is far from a perfect example of what a child of God should be. But even he is the means of directing David to the Lord. And their conversation, at whatever level, involved the things of God. And David, in having his mind maybe refreshed with thoughts of what the Lord is, what he's done. Maybe they talked together over the battle in the Valley of Elah. Maybe they talked about the fall of Goliath, when Jonathan had first met David. Maybe they talked about the things that had occurred and how things had changed since that time. Maybe they did. But whatever they talked about, it involved the Lord, because David's hand was strengthened in God. Let our conversations together and our visiting one with the other have this effect. That we leave each other's company. Yes, we'll have our shortcomings. We'll have our failures. But at the very least, let us, when we leave each other's company, have left the one we were with their hands strengthened in God. What a challenge that is to us. What a challenge that is to us as far as our conversation one with the other is concerned. The kind of visiting that we may engage in even in our homes one with the other. Let us see to it that we leave those we've been with their hands strengthened for the battle. Because we've been to the Lord together. We've been before God. Even as Jonathan and David were here before the Lord in the verse 18. I should just say in passing that this experience was one that was both bitter and sweet. Sweet because there was encouragement given. Because David had his heart refreshed, his hand strengthened again in the Lord. There was sweet fellowship together, no doubt. Spiritual fellowship, as I have indicated. Comfort and strength were received, but there is a bitter side to all of this. And the first aspect of that bitter taste here is the fact that Jonathan left. He went home. There were 600 men with David who had each of them individually made the decision to leave everything behind and stand with God's anointed, to cast in their lot with a vagabond, but who had been set apart by God as the next king, to throw in their lot with the one rejected of men, despised and hated, but one in whom they saw the choice of God. But Jonathan did not join them. That was a tragedy. I have no doubt that David, though encouraged and strengthened in the Lord, was disappointed in this. Though they parted one from the other with the happy prospect that they had discussed of David sitting on the throne and Jonathan next to him, sharing in the kingdom, a happy prospect indeed. I'm sure it encouraged Jonathan's heart, made him happy, made him glad to think of that. I wonder, did it cross David's mind? I wonder, will it ever be? Because you know, there's a principle in God's word. It is expressed by the apostle in 2 Timothy, in the chapter 2 and the verse 12. And it's this: if we suffer, we shall also reign. The only way to partake in the kingdom is to bear the cross. The only way to reign with Christ is to carry the cross with Christ. Now that's a spiritual principle. It's one that Jonathan thought he could short circuit here. That he could have the kingdom. That he could share in the crown. That he could sit next to the throne. But not bear the cross and the reproach of being with David in the days of his rejection. And if you know the history of after events, you will know that this was the last time that David and Jonathan were ever to meet. By missing his last opportunity to throw in his lot publicly and visibly with God's king, Jonathan now set himself on the path to an untimely death at the side of his father in Mount Gilboa. He never made it to the side of David's throne. He died beside Saul, the old king. And he didn't share in David's throne because he didn't share in David's reproach. He went home. That must have been a disappointment. I don't intend tonight to speak about Jonathan because it's David really that we're looking at. But what a warning and a lesson he is to all of the Lord's people to carry the cross. Don't go home. David stayed in the wood and Jonathan went to his house. What a contrast. For the comfort of life, there are those who are not prepared to stand outside the camp with Jesus Christ. It might even be in some instances for the sake of a house or because of a job. Or because of popularity. Or for one thing or another. Oh, they want to be an encouragement to the people of God. But they're not prepared to stand outside the camp. We have to recognize that as a failure on Jonathan's part. And while we look at David, we have to be aware of these little side actions that are going on. Don't be like Jonathan in that sense. Oh, be like him. And be an encouragement to God's Davids. Be an encouragement and a helper to the saints of God, especially in a day of hardship and difficulties and trials and oppressions. That's why God's people assemble together. Hebrews 10 and 25 makes it clear that that's why we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. Because of the day of apostasy that's developing all around us. Because of the opposition of the world and the darkness and the wickedness that prevails in the world. God's people are to get together. Especially for public worship. Be like Jonathan in that sense. Come, encourage the people of God. Let your conversation be of the Lord. That there might be strength imparted to others. But in this sense, don't be like him. Don't try to be an encouragement to the people of God and yet at the same time fit in with the world's crowd. Stand outside the camp. Stand with God's people. Throw in your lot wholeheartedly with them. And learn by way of contrast from Jonathan's example in this matter. But then we move on to notice that there is renewed treachery and threats against his life, and these drive him to the Lord. We have seen how in the whole scenario, and we've read quickly through it tonight, but as it develops, there is this interaction, first of all, with Jonathan. But then as the situation develops, David is driven to the Lord. It's a good thing to have the fellowship and the encouragement of God's people. But as we see in Jonathan, they have their limitations. David is now driven to the Lord as the circumstances develop. He is forced by the circumstances, yes, to be grateful for Jonathan's encouragement, no doubt, but to get beyond that and to recognize, I need more than the encouragement of a fellow believer. I need more than the encouragement and the comfort of a fellow saint of God. I need the Lord himself. Now, this is what happens here, and we'll get to that as we follow through in these events. He's faced again with treachery, because in verse 19 and following, the men of Ziph go up to Saul. Saul is still in Gibeah, his home city, or the city that he has made his royal base. And these men of Ziph go up to him to betray David. Now, I have no doubt this was a severe blow. It may not have been a surprise in that he's just coming from Keilah, and that's what had happened there. Maybe it was a surprise. Maybe when he got out of the Keilah difficulty, he thought, well, that'll maybe not happen for a long time again. And the next thing you know, the men of Ziph are doing the same thing. You know, it seems that the child of God isn't really that far from treachery. There's always enemies around that are ready to betray, to turn against us, even the Savior himself. And those of his closest numbers turn against him. Turn away from him. Those who had followed him in John 6 turned back and went no more after him. Judas, of course, the one who betrayed him. And those who follow in the Savior's footsteps can expect to have to deal with treachery and betrayal. These were men of Judah. These were of his own tribe, his own kin, his own extended family, we could say. And yet, in order to curry favor with Saul, these men proactively betray David. Saul wasn't in the area. Saul wasn't, as it were, making advances toward the men of Ziph, but they of their own accord, for no other reason than to curry favor with Saul, go to him and say, you know, David's down with us now. Why don't you come down and kill him? They pledge themselves with Saul to David's destruction. Now therefore, verse 20, O king, come down according to all the desire of thy soul to come down, and our part shall be to deliver him into the king's hand. That's what they were ready to do. They're going to destroy him. This incident, among other things, emphasizes the need for the Christian to exercise extreme caution as far as committing ourselves to men is concerned. We are, and I speak for myself, we are too easily bowled over by others. And we are led to think that here is a man and he's a wonderful person. And for whatever reason, they have a profound effect upon us. And we lose all sense of caution. We lose all sense of discernment and we're just blown away by this person. Maybe they have a vivacious personality. Maybe they have wealth. Maybe they have some kind of lifestyle that we wish we had. Whatever it might be, here's someone and they just bowl us right over. And we lose all sense of reason and discernment, and we're just sucked right in, taken in by them. It happens. We need to learn to be cautious. In Micah chapter 7, there is a word there along these lines. Micah 7 and the verse 5, and it's this: trust ye not in a friend, put ye not confidence in a guide. Keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom. For the son dishonoreth the father, the daughter riseth up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and the man's enemies are the men of his own house. And you'll recognize that these are words that the Savior himself quotes later on to his disciples. There is a text as well in John chapter 2 where we have the Lord Jesus' attitude in this regard to men. Verse 23 of John 2. But when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed in his name when they saw the miracles which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. Now these were just fair weather Christians. These were not true converts. They were just bowled away by the miracles that they saw, and they professed faith in his name. The Savior didn't commit himself to them. There is a sense in which, while we value the fellowship and the friendship and the encouragement and the comfort of God's people, there is a sense in which we cannot commit ourselves to that person. In the sense that we cannot so lean on them and build on them that they become our foundation, that they become our refuge, that they become our hope, our strength. And if something happens to them, our world falls apart. We're not to commit ourselves to men in that way. David is learning this. He is learning that these men, whom he may well have expected and anticipated, would help him, at least would offer him no harm, even if they were no better than merely being neutral. He would have expected that. But he learns. He learns not to trust in men. We need to learn the same lesson. Men will fail us. Doesn't matter how good they are, how well-intentioned they are. That's why you don't trust in a preacher, or trust in elders, or trust in friends, or trust in anybody. Oh, there is a sense in which we value friends like these, and rightly so. But we don't want to get to the place where we commit ourselves to that person and that we make them the basis of our hope and our comfort and our strength. David learns here, men will fail. Jonathan has failed him. The men of Ziph now betray him again. And he learns, I can depend, in the fullest sense of that word, I can depend on nobody but upon the Lord. The treachery of these men leads to a time of great mortal danger. For Saul now launches an aggressive manhunt. That had already been begun in the wake of Keilah. And the verses 14 and 15 really give us a summary of Saul's intentions and plans at this time period. David abode in the wilderness and strongholds and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. So that's where he is. These words apply to the time that he was in that area. Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. It was all the desire of Saul's soul, according to verse 20. It was well known, publicly known, even in Judah. And the men of Judah really weren't the bosom friends of Saul, because you remember how in the previous occasion he has indicated that his own tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, was much closer to him. He had used royal favor to benefit that tribe. And there was that sort of ethnic unfairness and ethnic imbalance, as far as Saul was concerned, toward his own tribe. Yet even the men of Judah and Ziph knew that it was all of Saul's soul. It was something that consumed him to come down to find and to destroy David. And in the verse 23, we have Saul's resolution. If he be in the land, I will search him out throughout all the thousands of Judah. And David sees now, according to verse 15, David saw. He sees now, and more clearly than ever, that nothing but his death is going to satisfy Saul. That's what it's come to. His life is now in grave danger. It's a time of increased clarity then of what the stakes are in this struggle. God has called them to a certain path. We have been following him along that path. The stakes are high. The stakes now involve his life. It's a matter of life and death. This calling that God has given to him. And David is now driven by these circumstances to the Lord in prayer. I know that from the words of the Psalm 54. Let's turn to that 54th Psalm, please. Psalm numbered 54. Because here we have David's words, I believe, on this occasion. Now, there was a second occasion over in chapter 26 of 1 Samuel where there's almost an identical rerun of events where the men of Ziph betray him a second time. But I believe that the words of the Psalm 54 refer to this first incident, and I believe that on the basis of the words of the title. It's to the chief musician on the gynoth, which is just stringed instrument, Maskell, that's a psalm of instruction, a psalm of David, when the Ziphim came and said to Saul, "Doth not David hide himself with us?" Now, that little sentence, "Doth not David hide himself with us," is an exact repetition, word for word, not only in the English but in the original, of the statement that appears in 1 Samuel 23 and the verse 19. And for that reason, I take it that this psalm refers to the incident in chapter 23 rather than in the rerun in chapter 26. But let's just quickly read through these verses. "Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They have not set God before them." Selah. "Behold, God is mine helper. The Lord is with them that uphold my soul. He shall reward evil unto mine enemies. Cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O Lord, for it is good. For he hath delivered me out of all trouble, and mine eye hath seen his desire upon mine enemies." Now the fact that David can pray in these circumstances that we're thinking of tonight is a key, it's a key thing. It's an important thing. He can pray. That's a wonderful thing, you know. In circumstances like that, he can pray. Jonathan is gone. The men of Ziph have failed him, but he can pray. There is still open to him communication with his God. Not only can he pray, but he does pray. He takes advantage of that opportunity that God has given to him. We need just very quickly to and simply to look at the content of his prayer on this occasion. He prays with what he said describes elsewhere as clean hands and a pure heart. I know that because of what he says in the verse 1. If you think about what David says here in the verse 1, it's a very solemn and sobering thing. "Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength." Particularly that second phrase, "Judge me by thy strength." O God, step into this situation and judge me. Do justice for me. Now, if that's going to be a beneficial thing for David, if God is going to exercise justice in his power in David's case, and that be a benefit to him, David has to be clean and pure before God. He has to come before God in this instance with clean hands and a pure heart. If he comes with wickedness and sin in his hands, what does justice demand? Justice will demand the punishment of that sin, the chastisement of that sin. It certainly will not mean deliverance from the enemy. So here there is, even in the petition that he prays, an indication that David is confident of his righteousness before God. That would cause us to think of his justified status. "The Lord imputeth not iniquity." As Psalm 32 says, "Blessed is that man." He's a justified man, yes, but he's a sanctified man. He's a man who is living clean and pure, holy before God. He has taken time to prepare himself. Maybe he has had to confess sin, to deal with sin, to put it away before he can pray like this. But at least he has done it. He has prepared himself. He has cleansed his hands. He lifts them before God. And he's convinced of the justice of his own cause, the rightness of what he is about. And he says, Lord, work in justice and power. Knowing that that will mean his salvation and his deliverance. You know, many times we come to pray, and if we were to use this word, it wouldn't mean deliverance. If we were to say, O God in power, come and judge me. Does our conscience not even now tell us? If I was to pray like this on many occasions, it would mean chastisement. It would mean the Lord would lay the rod upon my back. It wouldn't mean deliverance. It would mean, in fact, an evidence of the Lord's displeasure, because I have sin in my hands. My heart is not pure. My heart is not clean. But here's David. He's living as a hunted refugee in the hills. But he has kept himself right with God. You know, no matter how difficult life may get, it is possible to live this way. By God's grace, we can keep ourselves from sin. It may not be easy. Life may bring difficulties and trials, although I hesitate to even draw a parallel between anything we experience and what David's going through, because we know nothing like that. We know nothing like that at all. And yet David, even in those circumstances, could keep himself from sin. How much more reason there is for us to keep ourselves from sin, to maintain that pure and holy walk before God. I don't have time, one Christian will say, I don't have time to attend to the things of God. I don't have time to read. I don't have time to pray. I don't have time to keep myself clean and pure before the Lord. You're not on the run for your life. But David had time. David had time. And as he comes before God to pray, he comes as one with clean hands and a pure heart. And he had been jealous, it is obvious, to keep himself clean and pure and doing only what was right before God, even in very difficult circumstances. He prays in a concise, straightforward fashion. He has the whole thing sorted out in 7 verses. He has the answer. He has the confidence in God that all will be well inside 7 verses. How long did it take us to read it? Probably less than 60 seconds. And he had it all sorted out from start to finish. He gets to the point. He is forced by the circumstances that he's in to get to the point. To deal directly, straight with God, and not just to talk and to blather in prayer and to beat round the bush, get to the point. Because circumstances focused his mind and his heart upon the real need, the real issues that were here. Then look at verse 4, his eye is firmly on God. As he prays, behold, God is my helper. And wherever you read that little word, it's behold, it's a call for our attention. It's a call for us to look at something. But it indicates where the psalmist is looking. God is mine helper. God is my helper. His eye is on the Lord. In a time like this, it's vital that we see God. It is absolutely essential that we see God, for that's where the comfort begins. As in so many of the Psalms, there is this division right there in the middle. All the troubles, difficulties, and pleading in the first 3 verses. After that, there's joy and encouragement and blessing. What made the difference? He got his eye on the Lord. Behold, God is mine helper. What God is makes all the difference. And when we see that by faith, when we get our eye on the Lord, that makes all the difference. He's on the run for his life. Men have betrayed him. Jonathan has left him. But my eye is on God, he says. In the light of what he sees in God by faith, he can confidently assert that God has heard his prayer. He shall reward evil unto mine enemies. Verse 5. He shall cut them off. Verse 7 is especially interesting. For he hath delivered me out of all trouble. It's past tense. As good as done. It's over as far as David's concerned. It's all over. He hath delivered me. At this point, the battle may not yet have even reached its height. It's clear that it hasn't, because he begins by praying, Lord, save me, deliver me. Strangers are risen up against me. Oppressors seek my soul to take it. But he hath delivered me. You see, when we get our eye on God in circumstances of difficulty and trial, this is what we see. The complete victory and triumph that God works out in our life. It might get very hard at times. But like David, if we get our eye on the Lord, we'll see the finished product. He hath delivered me out of all trouble. And mine eye hath seen. Here's something he has seen. As he looked to God, what did he see? His eye saw his desire being poured out upon his enemies. He saw the destruction of the wicked. He saw the breaking up of their plans. He saw all those things as he saw the Lord. He saw that the wicked plans of Saul couldn't prosper. The treachery of the men of Ziph couldn't prosper. Why? Because I'm looking at God, and God does not allow those things to develop. He overturns them for his own glory, for the good of his people. Even though the trouble is still developing at this point, he can be sure that God will see him through. And he has that assurance in the place of prayer. He can pray in trouble. You know, so many of the Lord's people in times of trouble get so distressed they can't pray, because they've never been in the habit of praying. And they don't know how to pray. Life may be pretty easy for you right now, but learn to pray. Because there may well come a time when, if you haven't learned the habit of prayer and know what to pray and how to pray, you'll not know how to pray on that occasion. And you'll not have the comfort, you'll not have the sight of the Lord that David had and that saw him through in these difficulties. Let me just close with this. As we come back to 1 Samuel 23, he has the help of an unfailing God. In contrast to Saul, to Jonathan, and even to his own men in the recent past, because you remember how in Keilah they expressed fear. We don't want to go fight the Philistines. David is cast upon the Lord, and once more he proves the unfailing grace and power of God to help his child. The Lord intervenes here in a number of ways. 2 points in particular we just draw your attention to. First of all is the fact that he has sufficient warning of Saul's coming so that he can escape from Ziph. He moves to Maon in the plain on the south of Jeshimon, just a few miles to the south, but at least he's out of the terrain of Ziph. Saul still comes, he still has to face Saul, but he's not among traitors while he does it. He moves to this new area in Maon. He has sufficient advance warning of that. It is reported to him that Saul is on his way, verse 25, and they told David wherefore he came down into a rock and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And that's the Lord's doing. That's the Lord's working. Just getting the report to David in time for him to move, get out of the way before Saul comes. But then the climax of the drama is recorded for us in the verse 26 and following, where Saul went on this side of the mountain and David and his men on that side of the mountain. Now, what really happened here, it would appear, is not that there was a whole mountain between them. That's not really what's indicated here. It would appear that they were within sight of each other, and maybe even just like a rock ledge or a rock shelf between them. Maybe on either side of a very steep and narrow gorge. But one thing is sure, we are told, David is surrounded. Saul and his men have compassed David. There's only just maybe a shelf of rock, a ledge of rock, or a narrow gorge between them, however it may have been. But there's not much between him and Saul. He is surrounded, and Saul is closing in for the kill. In a short time, humanly speaking, it's all going to be over. The army of Saul has him cut off, surrounded, enclosed, and David is soon to be history. That's where it's coming to. That's what the climax of the story is. But just in the nick of time, there's a messenger arrives. And they say to Saul, haste thee and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land. You know, the Lord intervenes. The Lord helps. David had that assurance, as we saw in Psalm 54. He knew that. I've seen it by faith. God is going to do it. I have the answer before he finished praying. But the Lord often waits to the last minute. It seems that he takes us right to the wire. So often. And just in the nick of time, when it seems that all is lost, the Lord works in a very simple way indeed. There's no great battle. There's no great fight. There's just a messenger. He shows up, gives Saul a message, whispers something in his ear, and everything's changed. It doesn't take very much. The Philistines had invaded the land. It must have been some part of Israel that was particularly important to Saul, because as we know from other portions that we have looked at that relate to this time frame, the Philistines had made many incursions into the land, and he didn't care. They'd been to Keilah. He didn't care. David had to go and deal with them. They were in Bethlehem, as we saw. They have a garrison in Bethlehem. He didn't care about that either. That's in Judah. But wherever they invaded now, it was somewhere that touched Saul very deeply. How deeply may be seen in the fact that he was prepared to call off David, the hunt for David, even at the very moment where it seemed it was going to be successful. Well, the Lord just knew how to get him out of there. The Lord knew just how to intervene so gently and wonderfully and simply. It's almost comical, isn't it, just to see how the Lord just moves the pieces around. David's safe and Saul's out of the way. And David has been spared. And his faith in God is justified. You know, when it seems that we're getting right down to the point where the axe is about to fall, the Lord can work. As it pleases him, he can work even at the last minute. And sometimes when it's got past the last minute from our point of view, he can work most wonderfully and simply. Never be surprised at how God works things out. I believe that David saw the spiritual significance in all of this. We're told that there was a name given to that place. It's a name that stands out, therefore, in the scriptural record and no doubt in the mind of David. Selah Hamalekoth, the rock of divisions, or the rock between. Turn to the Psalm 18. And with this we're done. Psalm 18. Let's read the title. To the chief musician, Psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who spake unto the Lord the words of this song in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Now, I'm not suggesting that this psalm was written at this time. I believe it was written at a much later time, whenever the battles were all over. But there is nonetheless uppermost in David's mind those incidents where God delivered him from Saul. Reflecting back, maybe over the course of many years, at the point of writing the Psalm 18, he's remembering incidents of conflict with Saul. Maybe among them was this incident we have looked at in 1 Samuel 23. I believe it was. Verse 1. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock. If I were just to use the Hebrew word as it appears in 1 Samuel 23, I would say the Lord is my Selah. Selah Hamalekoth. The Lord is my rock. The rock who stands between. He is the rock who stood between me and Saul. Saul couldn't touch him. Didn't touch him. God was there. Jehovah, the unchanging God of his people. He is the rock. I believe David saw the significance. I believe he reflected upon that very incident even as he was writing these words. The Lord is my rock. The Lord is our rock. He is the same, for he is Jehovah. He is the same today as he was in David's time. We can reflect upon this incident and say, men may fail us. Even friends will have their shortcomings. While there may be much that we are to be thankful for in our friends, they have their failings. We all do. But there is only one Jehovah. And he is the rock, the unfailing God who delivers his people in answer to prayer. Let's learn to trust him, even in difficult times. Let's bow together in prayer, please.